And we are live. Yeah. It was so funny. The message that I always say, internalize it, is that you're unstable, but your internet is unstable. So here we are, live on Friday Night Feels, everyone. I am Patrick Manette, licensed mental health counselor and certified life coach. Friday Night Feels is a show that focuses on a variety of wellness related to issues such as mental health, addiction, health concerns, wellness, stress management, and much more. The focus of the show is to create connection and be able to talk about issues that affect all of us and how to be the healthiest versions of ourselves that we can be. Each show, I invite a guest, co-host, or cohort to join me and talk about their experiences. My guest tonight is Mr. John Sander. Welcome, John, to Friday Night Feels.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure. I'm so glad we were able to connect. Now,
me too.
John has been in the wellness field since 2007. He started out as a personal trainer and shortly thereafter began guiding yoga and meditation. With an additional background in food and diet, John continued to evolve towards health and life coaching before finally making his transition into psychotherapy. Currently, he is practicing as a licensed body-centered therapist, as well as offering ketamine-assisted therapy out of Denver, Colorado. John has dedicated his life to supporting people in their healing, as well as helping them expand their ability to find more peace and purpose in the world. So I'm so excited that you're here. There's so much to talk about. We were talking right before we went live. I'm like, I just better shut up because let's just go live and just get rolling. And my computer's having a little lag tonight. So I'm sorry, John.
Let's do it. Okay. No problem.
So where would you like to begin? I mean, you have quite a variety of experiences. Like, where would you like to jump in tonight?
I'm pretty open, to be honest. I'm kind of one of those people that just likes to pick up a thread and follow it. So if you have something specific, I know we talked a little bit about maybe you want to talk about the ketamine. If that's something you want to talk about, that's great. If something else is, yeah.
Yeah, I think the ketamine is really interesting. As I was telling you before we started, I really don't know that much about it, but I know it's a really important topic. So if you don't mind going there, I would love for you to share with me and with my viewers a little bit more about it and what it is and the pros, the cons, and why you work with it and what it does.
Is there some way, a leading question that's a little more specific? Because there's so much background. And I wouldn't say that I know it all, you know, by heart. Mm-hmm. So
so what is ketamine treatment for people who have never heard of it before?
Okay, so ketamine's it's still pretty emerging, but I think it's gotten pretty popular, maybe at least in the past 6 months. I feel like it's gotten much busier in Denver, but it's been pretty popular for a couple of years, especially in the form of clinics. So infusion clinics are a bit different than what I do, but I would say that's basically how it started. Infusion clinics are often run by sort of the medical model. Not always, there's definitely variations across the state, but what that generally means is you're going in, getting a treatment, usually by IV. Mm-hmm. It's usually about 45 minutes to an hour, and then you leave. The ketamine itself has medicinal properties or therapeutic properties that we believe help with depression. And in my experience, that's true. There is some debate about whether how much of its active properties are due to being partially an opioid and how much of it is actually working on the depression. I think there's a very small Harvard study or maybe a Stanford study that says that it's an opioid blocker versus an antidepressant. But most people kind of dispute that, especially people who are in the industry and say that it has, you know, bigger properties than that. Delivering it via IV is kind of the old school way to do it. And it's kind of a hands-off approach. Okay. As I said, you go to a clinic, you sit in a chair or on some kind of a lounger or something like that. They hook you up to an IV. You get the medication slowly over 45 minutes. Someone's usually sitting in the room with you, but it's usually a medical professional, okay, a medic or a nurse or something to that effect. Although I know there are ketamine clinics that do have therapists in the room. But I think traditionally, if you can call you know, if there's actually a traditional way that this developed, it would just be about delivering the medication, sending you on your way.
Okay.
So how it's been evolving is that we're also learning that you can actually vary the dosage from psycholytic to psychedelic, is kind of how we talk about it. Okay. And we can actually potentially facilitate work within the ketamine sessions from a therapist. So it's not just sitting there by somebody, but it's potentially interacting or intervening during the session, depending on, you know, what's coming up for them, and, you know, what your relationship with them is, and what the intention of the session was to begin with.
Okay. And how did you get involved with that?
You know, I think I have a pretty long history with psychedelics. I mean, I was, you know, when I was in high school, I was in a part of the country that was really rich in MDMA. Okay. So lots of ecstasy in high school. And then I went to school in the mountains. So, you know, lots of psychedelics, and I've always experimented with them almost 50 years old now. So since I was, you know, 16, probably, been doing that. And so it was something I always believed in, and I thought was a helpful part of my life. Every time I look back on those instances, they've always been meaningful and held strong places in my personal experience. So, you know, it was something that I've always been interested in. And, you know, due to the illegality, I never got involved, you know, with doing anything therapeutic in the States. Mm-hmm. I've been out of the country a few times and participated. So when I heard about ketamine, it wasn't very attractive to me because it sounded like kind of like a narcotic off the streets, you know, but it was the only thing that was legal. And it's the first sort of the entry level psychedelic for psychedelic treatments.
Okay.
So I went ahead and did the training and actually warmed up to it quite a bit after using it myself, having experience with it myself, and then having a few clients and how good that was going for them. So I started to warm up, and there's some properties that I like about ketamine that I think is different. I don't know if I call it better, but it's different than other psychedelics. And I think it can be a good entry level psychedelic for people. Because the other ones tend to be much more, more intense would probably be the way to say it. Yeah, this is a little softer on the psyche and on the mental body.
And the psychedelic components, are those considered like side effects? Or is that like a permanent thing while you're in this treatment, you could have a potential of experiencing more psychedelic
effects? Yeah, that's a good question, because I think, you know, usually medical models are based on minimizing side effects, right? And I think originally infusion clinics were rolling on that precipice or that notion that we're going to slowly deliver the dose over a long period of time to minimize side effects. Mm-hmm. What many people who are ketamine-assisted psychotherapists, what they believe is that the side effects actually are part of the process and actually facilitate some of the work, some of the processing, some of the discharge. Yeah.
Okay. So this is really interesting because, as I said, you know, here in ketamine treatment, it's, I don't want to say controversial, but it's kind of like that. There's like a stigma around it, I think, with different places of it. It is, you know, some of the reasons that you said of, well, why in your experience, I think this is an interesting question, is there such fear of psychedelics in the mental health field? Is it because people think it's, you know, like taking ecstasy, or it's about getting high and not being present? What have you found?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of cultural, you know, backwash from that. You know, remember Reefer Madness, and, you know, people saying how dang, you're going to jump off out of a window or something if you smoke marijuana, and you know, it's possible that someone has done that at a time. At one point in time, but demonizing the whole drug is a bit excessive in at least modern day knowledge. I also think there's a legitimate reason to be scared of psychedelics, because psychedelic experiences can be very scary,
and very big and
very intense.
Yes.
So, you know, I see ketamine and people who do these kinds of things as, you know, you could call people like us pioneers, but I also think we tend to be sort of fringe practitioners. Mm-hmm. And I think there's always those people on the fringes. You can travel through history and recognize all kinds of people who were sort of shunned for what they were doing at the beginning and mm-hmm. eventually accepted by the people who were, you know, more scared, let's call it. So I think it's just natural, you know, for some people to be okay and some people not.
Right. And it's interesting as we're talking about this, I think about just what my experience are in research of any new medication or any new treatment at one point, therapy, everything at one point was new. And it's met with skepticism, and it's like, well, and we always compare it to what we know, right? It's like, well, it's not that. That's kind of the point. It's not supposed to be the old stuff, because even the stuff that's older that works, it doesn't mean we can't improve. It doesn't mean we can't grow. If not, none of us would really be in the mental health field, because we would just say, suck it up, buttercup. It's just, you know, it's just your willpower. So what kind of training did you have to go through? Was it pretty extensive to get involved with this?
Well, I think the training wasn't that long, because what most of the training that I went through was about being kind of a sitter, meaning you're just sitting there. You're not really supposed to interact with the client. You're just sit there as a support system, and they have their journey.
Okay.
So really, they were using it in a pure psychedelic way, the people who trained me, which means high dose, and they're just journeying, they're off in, you know, another galaxy.
Okay.
I'm a body-based therapist. I have three additional years of training in body-based therapy, you know, after grad school. Mm-hmm. And that is, to me, an essential skill to have if you want to be a ketamine therapist, because there's a lot of stuff that isn't purely cognitive that comes up, and understanding how the body holds trauma and how the body holds memories is super important to helping some of the folks process, because they can have very visceral experiences under the influence of ketamine.
Right. And from my understanding, the research I've done with ketamine, it, I think everyone's always looking for like the one and done, like the miracle pill. And anything I saw about ketamine is saying it's not that. It's it's a very, not extensive, but it's structured. What is your experiences with people when they come to you? Do they have that experience that this is like a miracle cure? Are they still involved with psychotherapy? What are you noticing?
I get kind of a hodgepodge, to be honest. Okay. I get some people with like pure, you know, classic capital T trauma, mm-hmm. and some people that I would call it like more developmental wounding, more developmental trauma that was very low level chronic stress over long periods of time and sort of hard to track systemically and hard to track explicitly. And so it tends to be really, resilient to work, because it's so hard to see, to feel, and to experience, because it's tucked so nicely away in the subconscious. So I get people that have been, you know, off and on to therapists for decades, mm-hmm. or people who, you know, have only been in therapy for a year or a short period of time and want to try it.
Okay.
It kind of runs the gamut.
Is there a specific criteria to be able to be eligible for the treatment?
Yeah, you know, it depends on the clinician. Some of the people that I'm in consult with are very specific. They do not offer ketamine treatments to people who aren't already their clients and who aren't, and who haven't been their clients for a pretty long period of time.
Okay.
I'm of the ilk that because of the potential rapid access of people's unconscious and the traumatic material, that it makes some sense for it to be a first line treatment, mm-hmm. Even though there's a risk, obviously, medically with the chemical itself. To me, it does often have exactly what everybody says about psychedelics, which is, you know, you get a year of therapy in 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. I think that's can be true a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. So part of me says, with these people who've been working on this for 30 years, you know, they didn't need to work on it, you know, more than say a year or something before you try something sort of bigger. But again, that's indicative of the kind of personality I have and the lack of fear that I have around pushing the boundaries. Right. Whereas other people would say, oh no, You want to wait till it's the very last option. You've been on every antidepressant. You've been, you know, you've tried every single thing you could try, and then you're going to try that. My thought is, why go through 6 or 7 or 8 antidepressants and go
and how traumatic that can be for people, right? Exactly. That I don't think we talk enough about that, of how, you know, it's funny because I have clients who will say, well, I know you're anti-medication. It's like, I've never once ever said I'm anti. I believe in the benefits of medicine. I've seen it change people's lives. I'm anti thinking it's one and done.
Yeah.
Because even if you have the good medicine or you have the treatment, you still need the support, whether that's coaching or therapy or, you know, a spiritual advisor. Like, we all need a team of supports. And I think when people try to avoid doing the work, the therapeutic work, that's when I feel they're going to hit walls and their progress is going to be harnessed. But absolutely. You know, as you're saying this, the one thing it reminds me of, oddly enough, is, you know, when I was in more of the addiction field in the clinic world, there was so much speculation and about Suboxone for opiate addiction. And I don't know if you're really familiar with Suboxone.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and it was interesting because when I entered the field, it wasn't as widely used. There was really the training for the physicians to be able to prescribe was a whole other level of commitment and everything. And now maybe like 10 years later, Suboxone is much more approved. And even, you know, we're talking, with methadone clinics and different things. So, because what they're, as we're seeing, is people need more long-standing treatment for some of these addictions. And instead of looking at it, I think when you're talking, it's making me think of my experiences in the field of the rigidity, which, yes, we want to be safe and ethical and keep our people safe, but we also have to look at, we have to evolve and develop as practitioners, as, you know, people in the human service fields, so that way we can really meet the needs of the people and what they're dealing with.
Right. Yeah. And I think a lot of those people who are more rigid would agree with that, except they would be very rigid as to how that's supposed to happen, which means treatments that can be beneficial and valid won't be brought into the public for, you know, forever because of the bureaucracy and all the people who are so scared, for, you know, some for good reasons, but we kind of have to push those edges. That's how things progress.
And we don't have to go into this, but when you said that you'd been out of the country, it makes me think of other places throughout the world. And I mean, even in the States, but, you know, who use psychedelics in their spiritual journeys and their spiritual paths and their spiritual practices. And, you know, I know people who have done those journeys and have had, you know, and I'm just thinking like historically all the different components of it, but it's interesting once again that it's been demonized, you know, and really seen, and I'm not saying yay or nay or, you know, any thoughts, but it's just, it's interesting that aspect of it is really focused on of this is the big bad about ketamine treatment.
This is a little tangential, but it kind of goes along with what you're saying. There's this, I like to bend the vernaculars around mental health. Like, for instance, the whole idea of locus of control. To me, there's just, you know, just ditch the word control already. It's a slippery slope. But you can't, you know, there's hardly anything that's really in your control. One minute you think you're controlling your car, the next minute a dog runs out in the road, you know, you're slamming on your brakes. Why do we even need to talk about control? And this is, I think, part of the reason why psychedelics can be so demonized, because you lose control. These are medications or medicines that cause you to feel out of control. And it's like, well, yeah, you need to learn how to be good with feeling like you can't control things. Then you can master life, because you can't. We can't control things. The illusion of control. So to me, that's an outdated term. The locus of control, it's just, you know, decisions, actions, and outcomes, learning the best decisions you can, learn from the outcomes, do it again. And then you can master life that way. I work with all mostly high achieving, high intelligence, perfectionist type people. So the word control, it's just so slippery with them, because they're going to start controlling everything.
And that alone, and I find that can be the, there's so much trauma related to control, like, you know, especially when there is, you know, PTSD and traumatic events. And then I think people spend so much time, as you're saying, trying to control everything that they're not really living.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like, that's why I say you can just let that word go. It's just, you know, when you're in a situation, you make the best choice you can. The better you get at making choices, the more, you know, the more you feel empowered in the world, the safer you feel in the world, the more that you feel like you're going to be okay. And you know, you're going to be okay because I have these choices.
And I think part of it, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Well, I also think too, it's also, as you're saying, it's helping people learn how to trust their decision-making.
Yes. Yeah.
And knowing that they're going to make mistakes and that's okay, but they can also learn how to make adaptive, healthy decisions.
That's true. And that's why the last part of that little bio I sent you was about, you know, helping people sort of expand, you know, beyond the prop system. A lot of psychotherapy, in my opinion, is about creating better prop systems. Whereas I'm hoping to help people dismantle the internal paradigm and find that there's a lot of freedom when you can dismantle that stuff that you call your identity. And that's a frightening process, because when people realize that there's really nothing to their identity, then they get scared that there's nothing to their identity.
You know? And then what's the point? Or
just and that's okay. My thought, what I tell them is, once we break this down and we face the sort of bumps in the road that created your identity, then you start getting freedom, and these other channels open up for bigger options, better choices. Mm-hmm. And then you start creating a life of purpose outside of these paradigms that you created internally for survival a lot of times, you know, because everybody has some kind of trauma or wounding in their background. And a lot of their personality is surrounded around the survival map that they made when they were a kid. And if you keep following that throughout your adulthood, you can't really expand in a way that I think creates a lot more like peace in your life, freedom. And that's kind of my activism, right? It's kind of the way I work. It's my activism.
It's interesting. As you're saying that, it reminds me of a recent conversation I had. I was a guest on the podcast, and they were asking me some of my views about, you know, like therapy and psychotherapy. And I said, well, one of the things that I know historically is there was such a differentiation of power in the therapeutic relationship, right? Like, I'm the therapist, you know, like in the old movies, right? Like, I'm the therapist, you don't question me, here it is. And I think, especially since COVID, I think that there has been such an influx of gentleness and, you know, really breaking down some of those structures of, wait, I'm not better than you, you're not better than me, we're working together as a team.
Yeah.
And it sounds like that's, you know, a huge component of the work you're doing with of trying to help people break down whatever dysfunctional systems they have to really find who they're meant to be and to live a life of peace and harmony.
Yeah, I might even suggest a tiny bit of a redefinition of, I don't actually believe in dysfunction. Like the map that people are following was fully functional at one time. It may not be the best option now. Right. So again, like things like maladaptive, I don't use those terms. I don't believe in maladaptions. I believe that everybody adapted exactly how they needed to survive in their early childhood. Mm-hmm. And that those things might be outdated. I like to say it's like you're running Windows 95 in the background, right? And it hasn't been updated, right? We're like 20 years ahead of that.
Right.
And so that operating system has some really great features, and we just wonder if there's any barriers in there. Yeah, right. And so then the process becomes, you know, what part of this system is do I want to learn how to use pointedly, and how much can I open up to these other options that are internal and external?
And now, you would, in your bio, you know, you shared that you also have a lot of wellness coaching and yoga. Can you talk to me a little bit about like the parallels there, or a little of those experiences? Because I always love hearing people's, you know, wellness journeys and all the different things that they've experienced. I always find it really beautiful.
Parallels to what exactly?
That's part of your life, part of your professional development, part of your experiences.
Yeah.
As a wellness coach and practicing yoga.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, my story, I'll give the abridged version. Up until about 2005 or six, I was a chef for a decade and, you know, I got caught up in the restaurant world, which means lots of drugs and alcohol.
Okay.
Right. And so, and so I did that for so long. And finally I got to that old proverbial, you know, sick and tired of being sick and tired. That's exactly where I was at. And I just, you know, literally overnight was like, okay, I'm done with that. And that's when I started, all right, I got to get my body back in order, you know, and started as a personal trainer. And as I was doing that, I took a yoga class. I'm like, this is great. I'm yoga, being trained there, doing lots of classes, and found that it was a really good bridge from just, you know, getting in shape physically to actually then learning about your body in you know, in space and the way you move in space, and what that can mean for your awareness and hacking that Windows 95 that I'm talking about, right? Like the ability to be conscious of subtle body feelings and movements was really a segue to then hacking those body movements and sensations to find, you know, early childhood experiences and body memories that create blocks and create, you know, your personality that sort of puts you in these patterns of doing the same thing over and over again without, you know, without any better results.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a way to hack the system, is to start learning about how your body shows the unconscious or displays the unconscious.
Right. How did you decide? There's so many paths in yoga. Did you experience different ones? And
I did. The one I really got attracted to in the beginning was called Anusara, and it was a slow moving alignment based practice. So it was very technical, and it was a bunch of A-type personality people who loved it because it was super hard and it was very heady, meaning there was, like, you know, you're moving quarter inches of your body to create adjustments and different kinds of alignment and stuff. So I got really into the sort of the intellectual, how do you align the body? How does the body work in space? So it was very biomechanical based.
Oh, I never heard of that before.
Yeah. Well, you know, not the best story. That the creator of Anusara was, you know, one of the gurus who eventually got, you know, taken down, canceled for, you know, for being a scandal.
Okay.
Practice was great. He kind of guess he went down the wrong path to some degree. But yeah, it was pretty popular. I mean, he had all over the world. He had, you know, people.
That's amazing. I remember when I took my first yoga class, I was so nervous
because
I had never done anything like that before. And the teacher was one of the most gentle. He was funny and was, you know, like, talked about, like, the stress of going grocery shopping, but then, like, the gentleness of just being your body. It was just like this beautiful walk between the two worlds of everyday life and then a yoga practice.
Yep. It's a nice bridge. It's a nice segue to learning to connect with yourself on a deeper level. And, you know, I kind of evolved. I was teaching a lot and then doing lots of teacher training as well. But I evolved mostly into just doing the really mellow classes, restorative yoga, yin yoga, meditation. I kind of got away from the really heavy physical practice and got more into the more subtle practice and the more still practices. So, I don't think I've actually taken a yoga class in, it's been a few years now.
Yeah, it was funny that you mentioned yin yoga. You know, there's so many great paths in the yoga world. And I remember there was a local place that would offer yin yoga on Friday nights. And so there was times where, you know, it's just a busy week. So it's like, hey, let's go and do, you know, and I just remember how there was times where it was a struggle. Like, I would just get irritated or frustrated. And then the teacher was really gentle. And she's like, because it's just supposed to, just let it be what it needs to be for you. And then by the end of the class, I was completely calm and relaxed.
What if we could do that with everything in our life, right? Like, what if we could, again, we're back to the control again, right? What if we could let things be how they are without being a victim of them, right? again, you don't need control then. If you can just, if you could say, oh yeah, this is how I'm feeling now, that's okay, I'll work through it. You don't have to control anything. You just kind of accept life as it comes and then learn to navigate your way through it the best you can. Mm-hmm. And I would also want to say that some of the theories or the ideals that I hold also have some privilege behind them, right? Like some of this stuff, and that's the conundrum of the yoga world, right?
Right.
There's lots of memes and I don't know, paradigms within the yoga world that are very privilege based. Mm-hmm. They don't take other people's, you know, struggles in life and into account,
right, and hardships kind of and lack, yeah, of ability. And it's interesting because even when we talk about in general access to not even ketamine treatment, which I wanted to ask you about that in a minute,
yeah,
but being able to have treatment, like even regular counseling, but you know, there's yeah, no transportation. I think, you know, and I can be wrong on this, I think with COVID kind of breaking down that system and allowing more people to have telehealth services and, yep, more access to it and more coverage, I'm hoping continues that momentum of giving more access to more people and, yep, not making it so difficult. I live in a pretty rural area where I know we have like public transportation is almost non-existent. So now that people can get treatment in at home or on their lunch break and they can just put on their phone, it is so amazing that,
yeah,
people have that connection. Have you seen an increase of telehealth services in your world since COVID? I mean, I know ketamine, you have to be in
person. Oh yeah.
For psychotherapy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yes, in Denver, it's definitely, you know, I know clinicians that are never going back to in-person. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think telehealth is increased, you know, exponentially. Ketamine, I work in person. I was trained to also, you know, for people to do at home.
Okay.
And there's a few companies that you can order from and do it at home on your own. It's okay. Just not what I would recommend,
right,
unless that's the only choice you have. And some of that could be financial, right? Because you can get the medication online, right? You can be approved by a doctor online. They send you the ketamine. You can do it at home and you don't have to pay anybody, but you're also missing out in the support piece, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, and the process piece. I actually have clients in my practice right now who called me after, right? They went through MindBloom or one of these other companies. They're doing sessions, but they have no integration and no support. So they're reaching out to me like, hey, this stuff's working, but I don't really know what to do with all the information that's coming up.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, that's why, yeah, you don't do it at home alone.
Right.
Because things are coming up and you can integrate, you can intervene, you can help process those things and then help integrate them, which is essential for the long-term benefits of ketamine and psychedelic medicines in general. Mm-hmm. It's way beyond the session itself. It's how do I integrate what happened or what came up or what I processed into daily life?
And how do you do that? How do you do that with people?
Well, you have to extrapolate the information that came from the experience,
okay,
and then, you know, use the front of the brain to sort of reinforce it, right? Like with body therapy, I like to say we're working on the bottom of the ocean, right?
Okay.
A lot of psychotherapy works on the top on the surface. Right, we want to get down to the bottom and affect the bottom so that now what comes up to the top looks and feels different. Mm-hmm. Once it feels different, then you integrate it with the front of your brain,
right,
cognitively,
right,
which is a super cool process.
Right. So if someone comes to you, like, what is the process from start to finish? What does that look like?
With ketamine?
Yes. Yes.
So my process, and I just had my consult team the other day, we all talked about their protocols and everybody has a little different protocols, but you're going to need to see me at least 2 to 3 times for me to do some assessment, okay, to build some rapport, to get some background, and to get you prepared for the sessions. Then I recommend 6 sessions in 3 weeks. So it's very intensive. It's twice a week, 2 to 3 hours. The sessions are 2 to 3 hours each. So it's intensive. And then after 6 sessions, we have a talk about what the future looks like. Some people know that they're going to want or need a couple more sessions, which is fine. Mm-hmm. Other times they're feeling better And I say, okay, let's wait like 2 weeks and then let's have another conversation, see how you are, and then plan, you know, for your care moving forward. Sometimes that's therapy. Sometimes they're like, hey, I think I'm doing good. And they're often on their way. Other times it's, you know, come back and do a few more sessions. So that's kind of how it looks front to back.
Okay. And then, so what I've seen is different time periods. So some people might need a booster, or they might need it if they're struggling. Why would they need that? Is it?
So there's two reasons that I can think of right off the top of my head. One is that the ketamine itself is a short-term solution. Okay. Right? It's the medicinal properties are going to wear off depending on how much you've processed and how much you've gotten out of it experientially.
Right.
Then you carry that forward and that can help you. So sometimes you can break some of the trauma and it can be sort of a permanent fix. But now we're going back to what you and I talked about originally about what's wellness. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you know if someone's well?
Right.
So sometimes the effects slowly wear off over time. I just had a client call me that it was a year ago that they did a six series with me. And they said, hey, I've actually felt better overall the whole year, but I can feel myself slipping a little bit. And I'd like to talk to you about what you think I could do. And we talked about, you know, do you want to do a few sessions? Do you want to just go through a whole nother six series? So that's a good example, is this person feels better. They're doing better overall. It's got longevity over the year, but they can still feel some of these things churning under the surface and feeling like they're actually getting a little more prolific in their experience. So instead of going back to antidepressants and things like that, she just said, you know, would it be something to do to like do another series? I'm like, yeah. And then talk about potential maintenance over every, you know, 3 months or 6 months, do a session or two. And yeah, all of those things are possible. It's really subjective and unique to each client.
Okay. And then I'm assuming, you know, when I used to work in the addiction clinic, like I was saying, our treatment plan was very detailed and there was like 8 different life areas that we had to include. I think it's more now, you know, everything from like physical to emotional to live. And because, you know, there's so much to a person's life, I'm assuming that's part of also some of the treatment you do is like, so what are you doing for our physical? What are you, do you have a PCP? Do you drink enough water? I'm sure that like we were saying, it's not a one and done. It's a lifestyle change as well.
That's true. That's the hardest part for people to really embody, because the way that I work, even outside of ketamine, just my sort of the modality that I use, the lens I look through, I tell people, this isn't skill building, this is a lifestyle,
okay,
right? You're building a relationship with yourself. And if you reduce it to skills and checklists, to me, it's missing a big feature. And I know that that's counter to a lot of mental health interventions that are just pure skill building. And you could argue that people get skills out of the way that I work, but I like to see it as they're learning how to be in relationship with themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's not just a skill. It's a relationship. Right. It's not a hack.
Okay.
It's like you're building a different way to be with your internal experience and self. And that's, to me, much more robust and paradigm changing.
Right. And do you have people who are seeing other therapists that come to you just for ketamine treatment?
Yes.
And continue with their therapists? Okay. Cause mm-hmm. I've seen that more often now.
I just had a new client call me yesterday who said they had talked to a ketamine therapist just before me who wouldn't let them continue with their current therapist. And for me, it's a case by case basis. Okay. I know that some clinicians are just like that. If you're seeing two therapists, they just think it's a liability or whatever. And sometimes it is.
Okay.
But as I told them, you know, if it becomes a problem, I'll let you know. If it's something I get like, hey, I get concerned about, you have a therapist who works very different than me, then we've got competing sort of information and that can become a problem.
Okay.
But I know the therapist style of this person, and they are body-based therapists. So the chances of them receiving very similar information is good. And right. They have a long-term relationship with this person. So if I can support that and keep that going, that's great.
Okay. Wonderful. And what are some reasons that someone may not be appropriate for ketamine treatment?
There's some medical reasons, any kind of heart disorders, Temporary things would be people on like benzodiazepines, although that's not a contraindication. It's more of a interrupter, meaning it might interrupt the effectiveness of the medication. So it's, okay. I don't think it's anything that's going to hurt. Of course, just, you know, caveat that I'm not a doctor. So I'm talking about medical things, right, and I don't want people to think I'm giving medical advice. Right, I'm not, right. It's just what I've observed. So there's certain health conditions, most of them are around heart and blood pressure, that are contraindicated for ketamine use. And then certain medications, I think maybe MAOIs, I'd have to look back at my paperwork. Luckily, my prescribers are the ones that do the medical eval. Yeah,
so they cover all of that.
Yeah, they cover the medical parts. For me, mental health wise, what would keep them, what would make them not a good candidate? This is an interesting story. So people who have a history of psychotic breaks probably would not be a good candidate. People with bipolar might not be a good candidate because it could trigger manic episodes. The thing is, I had an interesting experience with the psychotic break stuff where I had a client who did not have a history of psychotic breaks, appeared to be broaching that bridge after one of our sessions, having a break. Was talking about, you know, things not being real, and it took us about 20 minutes to get through that, because he was, you know, probably in the beginnings of a sort of a panic attack and going on and on about things not being real. And the interesting thing is, we backed off on the dose the next time. They didn't have that experience. Then we went back higher to where they were before and didn't have that experience. Then we went even higher for their last session and they didn't have that experience. Theoretically, did we break a psychotic break propensity? Don't know.
Right.
So that would be a contraindication, but I've had an experience where it seems like it actually helped get through something that was at least akin to a psychotic break.
Right. And I'm sure with all of that, with any therapy, you're careful and cautious. So they know, okay, this is what we do. Let's do it safe. And because with other sessions you're saying, it sounds really important that they are a good candidate for it. So it is safe and they're able to, you know, get everything they can out of it.
Yeah. Safety is a big issue. And part of the argument in the ketamine world is around the safety. So it's pretty safe drug historically. The dangers of ketamine itself are the real, like, intense dangers, the ones like what they call laryngospasm, which is your the muscles in your throat spasm and close your airway. That happens typically in surgical procedures under anesthesia or in emergency situations where people are giving very, very high doses of ketamine. Mm-hmm. And there's been some talk. I know that I've talked to a few anesthesiologists who that's what they brought up, the laryngospasm. But my medical attorney who did my paperwork says that there's no information that confirms that that's a possibility with low dose and sublingual or oral route ketamine. So, you know, it kind of worries me, but it doesn't seem like there's any good information that that could really happen. It just has a really safe history, even though there's some people who think it's really dangerous. So it's kind of interesting.
And are you seeing more research being done, like where people are more interested and really want to, you know, test it?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, that's exciting. So you have more data.
Yeah. Oh yeah. 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 Most of it's around, most of it's not around safety. Most of it's around, you know, dosing and, you know, what the mechanisms are, why does it work?
And that must be interesting to in other countries to see what other countries are doing as well.
Yeah. Australia has a big ketamine, research.
Okay.
Yeah. Wow, they've got a lot of good research over there. I had a friend, you know, clue me into some of that the other day. So, and we've got, you know, several different avenues that are being explored for psychedelics, even though they're kind of the same, meaning they're lumped into the same, they're not the same. I mean, ketamine's already a legal drug. you know, a controlled substance, whereas a lot of these other substances that are being explored aren't legal.
Well, maybe they'll have to fly you to Australia. I mean,
that'd be lovely. So. Maybe so.
I'm sure they have beaches just like the one in your background.
They do. That's it. Totally.
So just jumping a little bit, you know, it's interesting. I always like to see, how did you get into the podcast world with this?
What do you mean?
What brought you into wanting to do podcasts, you know, and talk about ketamine and wellness and your experiences helping people?
I mean, I think education on this is, again, the same reason why I'm writing this blog, how to choose your ketamine treatment, because of these, I've had a lot of people calling me having experiences in other ketamine treatment centers that are really strange to me. And so trying to help people navigate, you know, the process and choosing, like, what am I supposed to get out of this? And how do I know if this is the facility I want to, and so I think that's part of it is, right, I want to educate people on this stuff. But, you know, I've been a teacher and I have a bachelor's in philosophy. So I'm always interested in working through, you know, what it's like to be human and what that means for people. So, you know, I've been teaching and training, and it's just, I'm kind of a, you know, I just like to speak to people. So my dad's always said, you know, you should be a professor. You're good at teaching. And I'm like, yeah, maybe someday.
Hate grading.
Yeah, exactly. Can I get a TA for that?
Yeah, right. Teaching, I think, is amazing, but man, the work that teachers put in is incredible.
Absolutely.
And are you enjoying being on podcasts and having good experiences and kind of, you know?
Yeah, I enjoy it. I mean, it keeps me active on Friday night instead of, you know, going out causing trouble.
How is the weather? How is the weather there these days?
It's pretty well. It's super windy today, but it's been pretty nice. It's warming up, and you know,
we had a snowstorm last week. Okay,
did you?
Yeah, I'm a little bitter. Yeah, because it was getting nice, and then, and it was the heavy wet snow, and it was about 6 inches. So it was. I think we're all ready for spring.
Yeah, we got a pretty big dump in the mountains last week, but it didn't make it down here.
So would you mind sharing a little bit about this blog? Is that something you want to talk about, or do you want to wait until it's more developed?
No, I mean, I don't mind just, you know, first thing is what you said. I think the first thing I said in the blog, and who knows, it could change completely once I finally get the final copy. But basically, if anybody's website assures you in not so many words that this is a cure, that would be the first reason you would not want to go to that person.
That's really helpful. Yeah.
And sometimes maybe innocently, people, if you read some of their websites, they're stating what ketamine does without any caveats. I try to say it could do this. It could help you. It can help you. But a lot of you go to their websites and they're like, ketamine does this, ketamine does that. And I'm like, I don't know if I want to put it out there quite like that. Mm-hmm. It could, it's worth doing, especially if you have, you know, if you've been suffering long enough and you have the resources to do it, I think it's worth trying.
Right.
But it's not a silver bullet.
Right. And I think I like that because you want people to have the informed consent and also to know, you know, just like with any medication, it's like, ask as many questions. That's what I tell my people, whether it's your PCP or, you know, general practitioner, like ask all the questions you want, do the research, like, you know, making decisions of whatever you're putting in your body, whether it's blood pressure or something, you know, something else of, you have the right to know. And if you, why not, like, do that investigation, ask the questions, so that
people don't know what to ask, you know,
because it's scary. And, I think I've been in doctors where it's really fast, and it, you know, they're, you know, some of my experiences are they just kind of want to get you in and out, and then you don't know what to ask, like you're saying, and you're wrapped up because my mind is, I've done the Googling my symptoms. So I've probably died about 15 times.
Right.
Right. So learning how to go in and be like, all right, so I'm not dying, but I should have asked A, B, and C. I think that's an important discussion.
And keep in mind that, you know, the corporate complex, maybe that's not even a fair way to characterize it, but a lot of the first information that people are going to get around ketamine is going to be from the infusion clinics. Why? Because they have all the money in the SEO. Mm-hmm. So when you Google ketamine treatment, it's going to be a bunch of infusion centers.
Yep.
Then you're going to read their literature. They're not going to introduce you to any options.
Right.
They're not going to say you have options. Hey, you know, you could find somebody who has a therapist and do it this way. They're just going to tell you the research and what it is. And you may not look much further because the first two pages of the search are going to be all ketamine clinics, not necessarily therapists offering ketamine treatment.
Right. Right.
So the information isn't, it's not collaborative. We don't collaborate with infusion clinics really. And it's not because we're against each other necessarily, but it's not that the industry's not put together like that, where there's a comprehensive like list of things, which is why I wanted to do a blog that's like, how do you choose your ketamine treatment? Right. To try and start giving some structure to that.
Mm-hmm. And if people wanted to connect with you, is that, how would they do that? Or are you on social media at all? Or what's the best way to connect with
just,
you?
Yeah, just call me or email me or, yeah, call me or email me.
Okay. And what's your email? If you want to just say it, and then people can reach out to me.
Yeah,
if they're listening to the podcast.
Sure. It's johnsander@johnsanderlpc.com.
Okay, awesome. And if anyone's watching or listening, and you know, I can connect the two of you if you have any questions, I'd be happy to.
Yeah. I'm also happy to answer, you know, questions. If you're not in Denver, obviously I'm not going to be treating you, but
right.
If you're looking for something around the country and you just need a little bit of guidance, I'm happy to take a few minutes out of my day to give people some information. And yeah, if they want to travel to Denver and do 3 weeks here and do treatment with me, that's fine too. But
that's awesome. Yeah. So yeah. As we kind of like wind down, what's one piece of advice that you would like people to walk away with from this conversation?
I think what you said, ask more questions.
Okay.
Yeah. More critical thinking, right? Less accepting what people say and more, you know, pushing back a little bit.
Right. Yeah. And knowing that you have the right to do that.
Yes, for sure.
Right.
Which is hard. You know, it's hard.
Yeah. I remember I went to the doctor's once and someone had asked me if I had white coat syndrome, which I had never heard of before, where you basically, your anxiety and your blood pressure goes up when you go in to see a doctor.
See a doctor, so yeah, right.
And I was like, I don't know, do I? But I noticed like, as I'm sitting in the waiting room, like my practitioner was fine, but it's just the anxiety of, is something wrong? What's going on? Like, how long am I going to be here? And I don't want to be here, but... I've seen it time and time again. And I think part of my advocacy when I'm working with people is to be able to say, go slow. If you need something to go with you, I know that's hard with COVID and limitations, but write down your questions is another thing that I suggest to people.
For sure.
You don't have to remember it. Bring in the notepad, say, this is what's going on. I always, you know, if I go for my yearly exam, I have a list of questions because I'm like, I don't want to come back here. Okay.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, it's the best way. Doctors love, well, at least my doctor loves that. I send her ahead of time a whole like, you know, spreadsheet.
Oh, I love
so
that.
She has it in front of her and she's like, okay, this is kind of great. You know,
and I just put it in PowerPoint. I mean, I'm all about like graphics.
Yeah. And I'm old enough at 50 years old, things are starting to fall apart. So I've got, you know, all right, I have this thing in my toe. I think it might be arthritis. And, you know, I just detail it out. Cause that way, you know, they only have 10 or 15 minutes to see you.
Right.
So I want to be organized and make sure I get everything asked. And yeah, it's a great policy.
Awesome. Well, John, thank you so much for coming on Friday Night Feels. It's been wonderful getting to know
you and hearing
a different perspective. It's been really educational. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, me too. It was a blast. Thanks for having
me. Awesome. And everyone, thank you for watching or listening to Friday Night Feels. I always appreciate your support. And we look forward to seeing you in 2 weeks. Have a beautiful weekend,
everybody.
Everyone. Bye-bye.
See ya.